This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Keith Preston. Hey, Keith, nice having you on.
Hi, Robert. Glad to be back.
So we're going to be covering a lot of topics in today's show. I guess a good way to start off with is I see this on your – you have this thing, Keith Preston, a commie fascist.
Yes. Those are just a couple of quotes I gathered at random off various threads online and various social media forums, things that people have said about me.
So you have these two different guys. One of them's a left libertarian and named Craig Bolton, and he's kind of is he basically kind of implying that you're a fascist?
Well, more or less, or a racist, or a white supremacist, or something of that nature. Comment stems from an online conversation he and I had in response to the review that was written of my book by Sean Gabb, by Dr. Sean Gabb of the Libertarian Alliance in London. Dr. Gabb had written a review of my recent book, Attack the System, A New Anarchist Perspective for the 21st Century. And in the review, he talks about some of my views on the shifting power dynamics that have happened in the Western world over the past few decades, and how former outgroups have become in-groups and things like that, and how as a result of that, a lot of more traditional or majoritarian cultural groups have essentially become outgroups in many ways. This particular individual did not care much for some of the content of that review and described it in the particular terms that you mentioned.
And then you have this right libertarian, Paul Marx, and he basically says that if you pull up an Occupy rock, you're one of the creatures found crawling underneath.
Yeah, well, that individual is what Kevin Carson calls a vulgar libertarian. That is, he's the kind of libertarian that's a staunch apologist for corporate plutocracy, big business, big capital, and things like that, and has very little sympathy for anyone who manages to criticize any of that. And, of course, I am very critical of that. So that's why he refers to me in those particular ways.
Yeah, I mean, I got that too. Because I was involved with the Ron Paul movement from about 2008 to about 2010. I never ran for office, but in 2010, I speculated about running for office, and I did write down a platform. And I remember on one of the Ron Paul forums, like, I got mixed results, but there were some of the people on there saying, like, you sound like a total statist.
Well, they associate any criticism of big business or big capital and the power that it has over the wider society with statism. In their mind, there's no middle of the road point of view between being an Ayn Rand like defender of big capital on one hand or being a communist on the other hand, or some sort of left wing statist. A lot of people who think in those terms tend to be very unfamiliar with third way ideologies or ideologies that are critical of both big capital and big statism.
And you have this article, and it's called Who Am I, Left, Right, or Center? And you start out about describing yourself, and you said in the past you were, as you said before, you were on the far left, and you were influenced by people like Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Michael Parenti, Alex Cockburn, and you start off saying that you basically agree with a lot of the standard sort of far left critique of U.S. imperialism, but that also overlaps with paleoconservatives and some of the rightist thinkers in Europe and Russia, like Alain de Benoist and Alexander Dugin.
Yeah, well, the thing about that is virtually anybody who lives outside the United States and has had any opportunity to see American foreign policy in action up close knows what American foreign policy is really about. I remember once Russell Means from the American Indian Movement said that in Latin America, everyone from the poorest peasant to the wealthiest oligarch, you know, knows what the role of the CIA, for example, and institutions like that are in America. American foreign policy. So the standard far-left critique that dissidents in the United States will develop concerning American foreign policy, folks like Chomsky and Coburn and Zinn and some of those, is that the American empire is essentially set up to serve the imperial interest of the ruling class, to secure access to international markets, to secure cheap labor, resources, and things like that. This is basic, imperialism 101, if you will. And there are plenty of criticisms of that and critiques of that that are offered by thinkers from outside the United States, not just on the left, but by nationalists in other parts of the world, like European nationalists, like Russian nationalists, like Latin American or Middle Eastern nationalists or Islamists or anyone really that resists American imperialism.
And then you move on to economics, and you share a lot of the criticisms of plutocratic state capitalism that has been advanced by left-wing anarchists, or even, you would say, even Karl Marx had a lot of legitimate critiques of capitalism.
Well, the standard left-wing critique of capitalism is that it's a system of exploitation that is aligned with the state, that you have this privileged, artificially privileged ruling class that is aligned with the state and gains its own wealth and position of privilege from the exploitation of those on the bottom layers. There are differences of opinion as to how exploitation specifically takes place. The Marxists, for example, will say this is something that arises totally out of the market economy. The left-wing anarchists and some of the left libertarians will say, well, no, the exploitation really is made possible by the state. You wouldn't be able to have the kind of exploitive relationship between capital and labor that we see in modern industrial societies if it weren't for the role of the state. That's been a long-standing back and forth between Marxists and anarchists, but it also is involves critiques of big capital that overlap with those of some on the far right, social nationalist, distributist, and some of those points of view as well. You know, all of these points of view, left or right, argue that big capital has an exploitive relationship with those that are subject to it. That's workers, and smaller businesses and poor people and peasants. I mean, they may differ somewhat or even differ a great deal in terms of what their proposed solutions are or what it is they're specifically criticizing. For example, the distributists tend to be more socially conservative. They tend to be more concerned about the impact that capitalist exploitation has on things like families and communities and things of that nature. The Marxists tend to have a very narrow class determination. It's all about labor power versus the power of capital. The left-wing anarchists are concerned about the authoritarian nature of this kind of relationship. But it's all, all of these points of view circle one another in the sense that they're all concerned about the role of big capital in modern industrial societies.
Yeah, I think the thing to point out is the libertarians have this thing called the Nolan chart. And obviously, I mean, you have the left-right paradigm, which is totally fraudulent. But even the Nolan chart it's too simplistic because it says you're either a social liberal, social conservative, economic liberal, economic conservative, but it simplifies it way too much. I think the Nolan chart, it claims to try to offer an alternative, but it's just, I think the Nolan chart, if you're familiar with that, is just as intellectually bankrupt as the traditional left-right paradigm.
Yeah, well, that chart was designed by a fellow named David Nolan. He was actually one of the founders of the Libertarian Party back in the early 70s. And what he was trying to do was present libertarianism as a third way beyond the left and the right. And of course, the standard description that many libertarians have of themselves as economic conservatives and cultural liberals, although certainly not all libertarians describe themselves that way. There are many who would say that they're on the left on both social issues and economic issues, and there are others that would say they're on the right on both as well. But what it does, what that particular chart does, is it continues to perpetrate the false dichotomy between labor and between big capital and the state. The presumption behind that is that, well, you're either for big capital or you're for big government. And it doesn't really offer any kind of critique about how the two are mutually supportive of one another. The standard traditional anarchist view of the relationship between state and capital is that without the state, you don't have big capital, that big capital is largely a creation of the state, it's an outgrowth of the state. In some ways, it's the old feudal class reinventing itself as a capitalist class. And the Nolan chart doesn't take any of that into account.
And on social issues, you share a lot of the perspectives of the center left. And basically on issues having to do with government policy on abortion, gay rights, the death penalty, civil liberties, issues like that.
I probably am somewhat conventionally liberal on some of those kinds of issues, in the sense that I lean more towards the pro-choice side on abortion. I never had any problem with anyone's race or ethnicity, or with women having jobs that men traditionally have done, or anything like that. I look at that more from as I said in that piece you're quoting from, a libertarian individualist point of view, in the sense it's more about individual rights and individual accomplishments and individual merit. It's not the social democratic paradigm where we have to have equality for its own sake, that everyone just by nature of existing has to be equal. I tend to be more about the idea of individuals being able to express their own abilities and talents, regardless of these other characteristics.
So in that regards, you would agree with the sort of left libertarians, like the guy who criticized you?
Somewhat, yes, somewhat. With certain qualifications. Again, there are some left libertarians who really aren't that much different from the radical left.
So they're more culturally, you're talking about government policy, they're much more culturally leftist than you are.
Sure, sure, yeah. I tend to be an advocate more of meritocracy, meritocratic individualism, if you will. Many of them, at least implicitly, have more an egalitarian outlook. Egalitarianism is an end unto itself. I look at it more like meritocracy is an end unto itself, and that individuals should be able to rise or fall within a meritocracy according to their own abilities.
And then you swing back to the right on decentralist, anti-statist, or civil libertarian grounds. These have to do with issues like local sovereignty, homeschooling, gun rights, and right-wing free speech issues. And I guess that's pretty self-explanatory, but obviously you can point out give some examples of right-wing free speech issues.
Well, the obvious thing is opposition to speech codes in universities that are essentially intended to enforce leftist orthodoxy. That would be one.
So you're saying students could get punished in a disciplinary manner for expressing the wrong political views?
Right. Yes, exactly. Or in a more even more serious level, the criminalization of so-called hate speech, where expressing points of view about different things that fall outside left-wing orthodoxy are actually punished in a criminal sense. We're starting to see more and more of that kind of thing in European countries now as well. Now, those would be the two main things: hate speech and speech codes within universities, as far as free speech issues.
Or cases where someone could lose a job over writing something, saying something politically incorrect, the person loses their job, like a case like that.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Professional sanctions that are imposed on people for expressing the wrong opinion or a socially unacceptable opinion on some controversial topic.
And you also, you take some rightist leanings on rightist leanings on anti-capitalist grounds, and you share, you point out Alain de Benoist's critique of massive immigration that societies are experiences, but you point it out more from an anti-capitalist perspective, as opposed to the sort of as opposed to what you would get from the sort of mainstream anti-immigration movement in the United States.
Right. Well, the mainstream anti-immigration movement will say things like, well, you know, we don't like the fact that the United States is becoming a bilingual society with Hispanic immigration. You know, I don't consider that to be any particularly problematical issue. You know, I mean, I've spent time in European cities where if you go to an ATM, they have 10 different languages you pick from there. It's, you know, that's not an awful thing.
Yeah, I think those people, they're just trying to find the most politically correct way to express their dissent to that.
Yeah. And I think that the a much more serious problem is involves what de Benoit calls the reserve army of capital, and that is that the you have a vast array of power elite interests that benefit massively from mass immigration. That's why they're for it. That's why they push for it. You have big capital that benefits from the importation of cheap labor, which has the effect of wage suppression. You have the various bureaucratic agencies of the state that see opportunities for expanding their own areas of operation through new clients for social services and all sorts of things. Political parties who want to cultivate all of these groups as constituent groups, as voting blocs. Ethnic lobbies that want to bolster the ranks of their own constituents. There are many other examples of that kind. You know, clearly the mass immigration is something that's tremendously beneficial to the entire spectrum of the power elite. You know, even before you get into ideological questions and things like that. And it's really those on the bottom layers of the bottom socioeconomic layers who pick up the cost for this in terms of wage suppression, in terms of higher unemployment rates, in terms of overcrowded schools, in terms of overcrowded neighborhoods, higher crime rates, more social conflict. More congestion on the street, you know, all kinds of different problems that come out of this.
I'm going to get back to this article, but you have another article. You make a case to anarchists and even libertarians who are for open borders. You say that imagine you have this anarchist commune, and some outside force takes over the commune and just starts bringing in lots of people to the commune against the will of the members.
Well, the anarchist critique of the state is that the state is an illegitimate parasitical force on the wider society, and that basically the state has forced everyone to submit to its own rule. And then mass immigration that's being facilitated by the state and by state-allied institutions, what you have there is something where the people who are already being held as subjects to the state are being forced to associate with population groups that are being imported from the outside. The problem with the practical problems and consequential issues aside that come from mass immigration and open borders, the theoretical problem with that from a libertarian or anarchist or whatever perspective is that it fails to recognize, first of all, the degree to which the elite interests, including the state, benefit from and foster mass immigration. There's also the question that the matter that immigration doesn't take place in a vacuum. It involves the use of a wide assortment of public resources that are, maintained through extractions from the general public, through taxpayers and through labor and so forth. When other people are allowed to migrate into any one society from the other on behalf of the power elite and at the expense of the domestic population, you know, not only does that have some of the effects that I was talking about in terms of wage suppression, in terms of burdens on social services and things like that, but it's a type of forced association because those from the outside are also protected by anti-discrimination laws and things of that nature as well. Some are receiving direct state subsidies in the forms of social transfer payments and public assistance and things of that nature. So it's not that mass immigration simply takes place in a vacuum. And I think one of the major errors in the thinking that a lot of the anarchists and libertarians use on this question is they associate immigration with things like you know, someone moving from one neighborhood to another or from one apartment to another. And they say, well, what's inherently wrong with that? Why isn't that just freedom of movement? Or they think, well, wouldn't it be nice to be able to travel to any country you want to without having to bother getting a passport or a visa or something like that?
Yeah, but then obviously you would have if you allowed that, you would have migration, and literally it could be like a billion people migrating.
Yeah, yeah, they give no thought to consequences of this type. If we had 100 million people from China immigrating to the United States tomorrow, or to look at it from a more objective perspective, what would be the effect on Japan if 100 million Chinese immigrated to Japan tomorrow, or 100 million Americans migrated to Japan tomorrow? What kind of impact would that have on the Japanese society, on the Japanese working people, on Japanese culture? And that's something that they either think doesn't matter, or is not worth considering, or is irrelevant. But in terms of if you want to look at it from a purely utilitarian level, from a consequential level, the consequences of mass immigration are fairly enormous, and it's those on the bottom socioeconomic layers in the host society that experiences mass immigration that pick up the bill for this, and it's primarily the elite that are the beneficiaries. So it's really a form of upward distribution of wealth. And then, once again, from a theoretical perspective, it's not that it takes place in a vacuum, that mass immigration involves the use of a wide assortment of public goods and public resources that are extracted from taxpayers and from working people. There's also the question of jurisdiction. For example, libertarians who believe in open borders also believe in absolute private property rights much of the time. So they believe individual property owners or collective property owners should be able to discriminate against or exclude whomever they want. But they also believe that when it comes to public property, apparently anyone should be able to immigrate onto public property that they want. So, it's really like they're saying, well, it's okay to have mass immigration, but individuals and private property owners and collective property owners, businesses and so forth, should be able to discriminate against immigrants all they want to. So it's like it would be fine if we had mass immigration and everyone and they were all living on the street, as long as private property owners could discriminate against them.
Yeah, that sounds like a really great society where you have all these private property owners with their exclusive property and then millions of people starving in the streets. But to move on back to the article we were talking about, you go on to say that you are critical of the excesses of what you call totalitarian humanism, and I think you've explained what that means in depth in a lot of our other shows. I don't think we really need to go into much detail about what totalitarian humanism is, because there's so much thought. I mean, the audience can look that up. But then you go on to say that you've been criticized a lot by leftists for your associations with tendencies of subcultures like the alternative right or the dark enlightenment.
Yeah, well, of course, to the left, all of that stuff is evil incarnate. They view the alternative right, the dark enlightenment, and so forth as the...
Were you also, your show was hosted on Countercurrents at some point.
Yeah. For a while, Countercurrents very graciously agreed to host the program, and before that, on Voice of Reason, and then we finally started doing the podcast directly from AttackTheSystem.com itself. Yeah. But a lot of leftists, they look at our association with Countercurrents.
What are you doing on that white supremacist site?
Why are you associated with those god-awful neo-Nazis or whatever? Yeah. My view on that is that, first of all, I'm interested in giving everyone a fair hearing and considering all points of view objectively. As an anarchist, I think that independent thinking and critical thinking is the most important value before you even get into any ideological principles. And that means I want to hear all points of view from all across the political and cultural spectrum about all issues, including issues that are considered taboo issues. And also, in many ways, at least, I think the alternative alternative right and the Dark Enlightenment and other tendencies that are overlap with that are a necessary corrective or counterbalance to some of the excesses on the other side. You know, now that we have the a fairly large PC subculture that's very extreme, and that then more moderate forms of PC are essentially dominate the mainstream society, I think it's important to get some other ideas into the conversation and have some other voices be heard.
And that's a big part of totalitarian humanism is the cult of guilt by association. Like if you, I mean, you're someone could, yeah, because if you say, because if you're, guilt by association says that you're judged by all the content on a website that you're hosted on. Like that happened to me once back on Voice of Reason, and this guy said, "Oh, I like a lot of your shows, but they judged me based on another show that was hosted on the Voice of Reason network." That's the cult of a guilt by association.
Well, sure, and of course, that's what all of these professional watchdog groups do. They create these little family trees or whatever you want to call them, and they try to find all these branches that are sticking out, connecting all of these different supposed hate groups and neo-fascist groups and racist groups and things of that nature. It really reflects a very puritanical mentality, I think, in the sense that it's all about trying to root out what someone perceives to be sin or evil or something like that. You know, it's not about free exchange of ideas. It's not about discussing ideas and having ideas evaluated on their own merit. It's all about, you know, maintaining your articles of faith, you know, your 39 articles of faith and, you know, all of your, you know, points A, B, and C, and D, and E from the catechism or whatever, and then purging anyone or attacking anything that, you know, the left, substantial strands of the left, pride themselves on their supposed secularism, but what they really are doing is creating a whole new theocracy.
Yeah, because some people in the Dark Enlightenment, they will say that they totally reject the Enlightenment. But actually, I mean, a lot of the ideas that came out of the Enlightenment, I think, are actually good ideas, like open-mindedness and intellectual freedom. In a sense, the ideas of totalitarian humanism share some similarities between a lot of very sort of archaic, almost medieval ideas. They're very black and white, like we're good and this person is evil, like stuff like that.
Yeah, well, it goes a little bit deeper than that in the sense that a lot of the theoretical foundations of PC, of political correctness, and the strands of the left that reflect that point of view actually have their roots in philosophies that were very critical of the Enlightenment or very opposed to the Enlightenment, like the Frankfurt School. A lot of the thinkers of the Frankfurt School were actually very opposed to the Enlightenment and to rationalism and things of that nature.
So maybe the Dark Enlightenment should... Maybe the Frankfurt School is the Dark Enlightenment. Maybe the... Yeah, because I'm just trying to make the point that the Enlightenment isn't necessarily all bad.
Well, I think you could probably look at it like there's a counter-enlightenment that emerged, say, in the 19th and 20th century from both the left and the right. You have the counter-revolutionaries from the right who really did reject the classical enlightenment. Thinkers like, say, Joseph de Maistre or somebody like that. I mean, that's the true counter-enlightenment, I suppose. But then there was also a counter-enlightenment from the left that came out of the 20th century and systems like those developed by the Frankfurt School. So I suppose in some ways you could say that something like the Dark Enlightenment of today is sort of like a neo-enlightenment. It's sort of like this, you know, a neo-enlightenment against the left's counter-enlightenment, although it certainly overlaps in some ways with the traditional counter-enlightenment.
Then you go on to say that you support a regionalist and a ethno-identitarian movements as a bulwark against imperialism in the Leviathan state, and you give some examples of those. Some of them are the movements of whites, Christians, Europeans, and the Afrikaners, which puts you in the rightist camp. And so there are regionalist movements like the Lega Nord in northern Italy and the Southern Nationalist and the Texas Independent movements. But You also mentioned this, the Scottish independent movement, the Quebec independent movement, the Second Vermont Republic, which are more left-wing leaning movements.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I support self-determination for everyone, and that includes left and right. And it assume, you know, I would assume that, for example, in a decentralized North America, you would have some regions and some communities that would no doubt be somewhat conservative-leaning in their values in places like, say, Texas or the South or the Northwest or at least parts of all of those regions. And then you obviously would have others that would be more leftward-leaning, like Vermont or New England or the West Coast or something like that. And I don't see anything inherently wrong with that. And the same would be true in Europe as well. You know, the Scottish independence movement is more leftward-leaning. The Lega Nord is more rightward leaning, and that's fine. You know, like I said, I'm for self-determination for everyone. I don't think everyone has to be on the same page about everything. I think in many ways the dichotomy between conservative and liberal cultural values will always be there. For example, if you look at different societies throughout history, you see that, you know, many societies tended to lean more towards some kind of cosmopolitanism. Others tended to lean towards a very strong traditionalism. I've also noticed that more cosmopolitan societies tend to be societies that tend to be water-based. They tend to be closer to the oceans and so forth, more seafaring, whereas more landlocked agricultural societies tend to be more more traditional. You know, I think that probably explains, for example, why Russia tends to be a more conservative society traditionally than, say, England. I think it probably explains in part why In the ancient world, Sparta was more conservative, and Athens was more cosmopolitan in nature. And I think that dichotomy is always going to be there, and I don't really think there's anything inherently wrong with that. I think the two points of view in many ways provide a balance to one another.
And on the issue of your philosophical views, you describe yourself as a Nietzschean, and you basically have an elitist, non-egalitarian view of human nature.
Yeah, I do. You know, I think it's quite clear from observation that human beings are not equal in terms of ability, in terms of the kind of societies and cultures they create collectively. And I'm not coming at this necessarily from any kind of chauvinist point of view. Rather, I'm just saying that, you know, people are different in a lot of different ways. Individuals are different. Groups are different. Men and women are different. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think, you know, the fact that people are different, once again, I think it has a balancing effect where what one population group or what one group of people brings to the table might be different from what another group of people bring to the table, but they may both be necessary for the whole picture to work. And for all of its talk about liberation and things like that, a lot of contemporary liberal and left opinion, I think, is really more about a kind of enforced conformity. You know, they really have this idea of, you know, what the model human being is or ought to be, or what the model, you know, citizen of an egalitarian state ought to be. You know, even now, I was actually talking about this in a podcast I was doing yesterday with someone else. But what I find interesting in particular is the way that white leftists treat minorities. It's like they have this idealized conception of what a black person ought to be, or what a Middle Eastern person ought to be, or what an Asian person ought to be, or what a Native American person ought to be. And what I find is that they often react with extreme anger to people that they claim, against people they're claiming to be defending, when they don't conform to these models that they want to impose on them. You know, I've had conversations with feminists, with radical feminists before, and I say, well, what about non-feminist women, or what about women who, you know, who want to be stay-at-home moms, or the fact that in North America you can probably find just as many women that identify with some kind of traditional religion like evangelical Christianity as with radical feminism, if not more. And they sort of had this attitude, well, those aren't real women. What about gay people who lean rightward politically? You know, and those get ridiculed by leftists as insane or you know, mentally ill or something like that. So it's really interesting how they want to have this enforced conformity in the name of liberation.
And we'll move on to your podcast, Who Are the Power Elite? I think a good introduction to that is talking about the difference between the power elite analysis as opposed to the view of a conspiracy theories.
All right. Well, the difference between the two, the main difference, is that conspiracy theories usually postulate the idea that there are cabals of people operating in very shadowy, secretive ways, manipulating things from behind the scenes, and we can't really see them. I mean, you might be able to suspect them.
Yeah, there's the Illuminati, or there's like the protocols of the Elders of Zion, like stuff like that. Like there's this secretive cabal.
Yeah, there's a wide assortment of theories of that type, and those are two of the more prevalent, but there's a lot of theories of that type. You know, there's David Icke's ideas about the lizard people and
yes.
things like that.
I don't even know if he even believes in that stuff.
Yeah, but that kind of thing, though, I really think makes things more complicated than it needs to be. Power elite theory, authentic power elite theory, simply postulates that in any particular society, there are people who have power and those who don't. And those who have power use their power for the benefit of their own interest and the interest of the groups that they belong to. And it's not necessarily any kind of conspiracy. It can be right out in the open, right, in, you know, publicly observable. A good example was the bank bailouts that happened a few years back. I mean, that was really something where the power elites really stepped forward and said, we want this, and virtually the entire political class, you know, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, and conservatives, all fell in line right behind them. That's the power elite.
And one thing that the conspiracy theorists say, a lot of them tend to say that the elites are totally monolithic, that they pretend to have disagreements in public, but in secret they're totally in line with each other. A conspiracy theorists say that a lot.
Well, I don't really think that's the case. It's not the power elites pretend to have differences when they're really just conspiring.
No, but that's what the conspiracy theorists claim.
Yeah, but I don't. I think that's a rather simplistic way of looking at it, to say the least. The ranks of the power elite are like any other kind of political or cultural faction or economic faction. Collectively, they may have their own interests, but then within themselves, there are a lot of differences as well. Within the ranks of American foreign policymakers, that in turn reflects the prevailing consensus of the power elite generally, there are different points of view on foreign policy between the neoconservatives and the liberal internationalists and the realists. There are differences of opinion on social issues like gun rights, abortion, homosexuality, education policy, environmental policy. There are differences on economic issues. There are some that do favor a more Keynesian economic approach. They think that fosters stability. There are others that do favor a free market economic approach. They think that fosters economic growth. And there are some that favor more social democratic policies. They think that's a way of keeping everyone else in line by essentially pacifying them. There are some that say, no, we don't want to do that. Now, why not just use the stick, let them eat cake? That you do find these kinds of differences among the ranks of the power elite. But one thing that they normally are conscious of is they do have a common enemy in everyone else. They do want to preserve the empire. They do want to preserve their own collective system of rule.
So if you look at, for instance, the Koch brothers and George Soros, they may have some disagreements with each other, but I would say that most of the elites are pretty monolithic in the sense that they, in regards to that, they on the issue that they support globalism and stuff like open borders. I'd say on that issue they are pretty monolithic.
Well, yeah, because that's what serves their interests collectively. I mean, they all want to have access to international markets and be able to dominate international trade and international labor and have access to resources and so forth. So, of course, collectively, they're going to support the global economy. And open borders serves the interest of the vast majority of the power elite as well, because they do want to take advantage of cheap labor and do want to be able to engage in outsourcing. You know, they do want to be able to have immigrants from the third world staffing service industries in North America, while at the same time they're outsourcing other jobs, you know, manufacturing jobs to places like India. So that, yeah, of course. And, you know, I mean, even there are maybe individuals who dissent from some of that. But as a general rule,
yeah, like I'll give an example, like every now and then, like we had Ross Perot, who was a billionaire. And when he ran for president, he spoke out against stuff like outsourcing.
Yeah, well, Perot was an interesting character in that I think that a lot of his views can be interpreted in terms of his background, in the sense that he was a guy who started off small, and you know, he was basically a small businessman who became phenomenally, incredibly successful. So he still sort of had the outlook of, you know, your standard, you know, petty bourgeois type, you know, the guy who's a, you know, a successful small businessman who believes in free enterprise, but who's also a patriotic American and that kind of thing. And, you know, Ross Perot was very much from that kind of, that school of thinking. You know, he wasn't the kind of, you know, cosmopolitan globalist that you see represented by someone like Soros, not in any sense. You know, he just came from a much different cultural background, different kind of psychology, different kind of worldview.
And then there is the power elite. Then there is the power elite analysis versus the theory of a democratic pluralism. Can you explain what a democratic pluralism is?
Okay. Well, among political scientists who are apologists for the system, who say, "Yeah, the system we have in countries like the United States, it's a great system. You know, maybe it doesn't work with optimum." Productivity all the time. Maybe it's got its flaws, but no system's perfect. It's the best there is. And, you know, they will say that power is remarkably spread out according to their analysis. They'll say, yeah, of course, some people are more powerful than others. Some institutions and organizations are more powerful.
Or they'll say that the voter, they'll try to say the voters have the power.
Yeah, ultimately, yeah, the voters have the power, and the voters can express their point of view through lobbies and political action groups and all these kinds of things as well. You know, power is spread out among civic associations and rotary clubs and political interest groups and you know, local communities and labor unions and teachers associations. And, you know, in my view, the problem with that is that it doesn't have any balance to it, in the sense that, yeah, that's true. You know, that some local community action club might have some ability to influence policy in their town or something like that, or some organization that's formed around some issue. You know, the Association of Motorcyclists or something. I mean, they may have influence in the wider society on some petty level, but that in no way is comparable to the degree of power and influence that banks, corporations, and the state bureaucracy itself have, or the military-industrial complex. You know, there's no consideration of these kinds of power imbalances. It basically acknowledges the existence of just any kind of form of political expression, and assumes that, you know, assumes that that's democratic pluralism.
And then you have the classical elite theory that was developed in the 1920s.
Yeah, that's associated with thinkers like Robert Michaels, Mosca, Vilfredo Pareto, George Sorrell, some of those. And what they were basically doing is, a lot of these guys came from the left originally, and they were saying, well, wait a minute, if we look at regimes that this is, you know, when some of the earliest leftist regimes were starting to appear, they said, if we look at regimes that of the left that ostensibly espouse egalitarian values, or if we look at left-wing political parties that essentially that claim to espouse egalitarian values, like say the Social Democratic Party in Germany or something like that. We see that these kinds of organizations are organized in every bit as oligarchical and elitist a way as more traditional organizations or more conservative organizations. The Communist Party in Russia is not much different from the Catholic Church in the way it's organized. You know, it's got the guy at the top who's the leader, and it's got a very stratified, rigid hierarchy. And that led them to the conclusion, the elite theorists, that elites are inevitable, that there's always going to be some kind of power elite, and it's just a question of who the elite is going to be. They tended to move away from egalitarian theory because of that. And some of these are very classic works. Robert Michaels, for example, had his theory on the Iron Law of Oligarchy based on his studies of the Social Democratic Party in Germany. There's a great book about some of this that was written in the 1930s by James Burnham.
The Managerial Revolution.
Managerial Revolution, yeah, and that draws heavily on some of these elite theorists. And he had another book called the Neo-Machiavellians, where he actually examined the ideas of some of these people directly. That's worth reading as well if you want a general overview of this.
And you talk about you say Robert Putnam in the role of technological elites, but before I talk about the technological elites, I think I'd like to touch on Robert Putnam, because he has a book called Bullying Alone, and it's about this concept called social capital. And part of the thing is going on in society is groups that have high social capital, meaning people know a lot of people, interact with a lot of people, those groups are successful. And because I think there's a trend in society of a lot of people who are more socially isolated, or people who have maybe they have their family, and then maybe they have about four good friends, they have low social capital. And social capital is a very important concept.
Yeah, well, Putnam's theory is that heterogeneous societies tend to lose a certain amount of cohesion through the decline of social capital, that people who have nothing in common with one another are less able to find a sense of community or develop a sense of community. And as a result of that, you see a lot of social fracturing where people sort of retreat into themselves. And we can just see that in day-to-day life. We see, for example, how transient people are, about how nowadays people move to a different house or a different apartment every few years or even every year. I know in my own neighborhood, all of my neighbors seem to change over on an annual basis. There's very few people here in my neighborhood that were here a few years ago, and we see that even in more conventional middle class communities now. You know, and one of the lines of work that I'm in, I'm out in residential suburban neighborhoods all the time, and you know, every 6 months I go to a neighborhood and there's a whole new group of people living there, it seems like. Yeah, you know, people are very transient. People often don't, that may have to do with the increasing diversification of the society, where people end up having less in common with others. I think some of it also is rooted in the economic system, in the sense that, you know, people are constantly moving around, looking for work, relocating to new places, getting transferred and stuff like that as well.
So what is the main point he's trying to get across in his book of what is – is he coming at it from a political standpoint or more at it from a personal standpoint?
You mean Bowling Alone?
Yeah, I'm Bowling Alone.
Well, I think what he's concerned about is the decline of community. I don't think he's necessarily
pointing. Because, he's politically, he's more aligned with the establishment. He's obviously not really a dissident.
No, he's not really a political dissident, and I don't think he's really pointing the finger at anyone, in terms of, in a political sense. I think he's simply saying, well, look, this is a social problem. You know, this is a problem when you have a society where individuals become so atomized that they are not able to form any sense of community, and because there is no common identity on which to do that. And that does diminish the overall cultural capital, social capital. does contribute to a lot of other forms of social fracturing and social dysfunction. I think that's what he's mostly worried about.
So, yeah, he's not really talking about politics, but he's saying that it's unhealthy for the individuals. It's psychologically not healthy. Is he making that case?
Yeah, for the individual and for the wider society, because society becomes less cohesive and more fractured, and which in turn is going to lead to more social pathologies.
Or psychological problems, or you get people who are have depression and all these different
mental health, yeah. Alcoholism, you know, broken families, things like that.
And then, back on topic. To our previous topic, Robert Putnam has his theory of the technological elites.
Well, his idea there is that as society has become so dependent on technology, that the mere knowledge, the ability to be able to design and maintain the whole technological apparatus has by itself created a new branch of the power elite, and that is the elite of scientific and technological specialists, you know, the people who are in charge of designing and maintaining this technology. That really gives them a strong degree of power because of the way that we're so dependent on all of that. Think about the growth of high-tech industries as a major political force.
Industry like Google, for instance.
Facebook, the Zuckerberg characters like that, the Silicon Valley, the computer industry, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, those kinds of characters. All of that is rooted in the growth of high-tech society, and out of that comes a political power base that in some ways is supplanting some of the older political power bases. I interpret a lot of the political conflict, at least at the elite level in our own society today, in terms of you have this traditional WASP elite ruling class that's rooted in older industries, banking and oil and armaments and agriculture, versus some of these newer, more high-tech industries that have emerged in more recent decades. And it's the power that this technological base gives them that translates into political power.
And then you mentioned Thomas Dye and the development of consensus among elites, but I mean we kind of covered that already, but is there anything you want to add about Thomas Dye?
Thomas Dye advances the theory that among elites through their institutions like think tanks, like the universities, the elite universities, they have the effect of developing a consensus on what their own interests are, and that political and economic policy, foreign policy and things like that are structured around the consensus of among the elites. And that's not to say there's uniformity of opinion or disagreement among the elites. There certainly is. But as a general rule, I think it gets back to what we were talking about earlier, where we were saying, well, the elites typically recognize that the global economy is in their interest, that mass immigration is in their interest, that in the United States, the creation of the current the developing two-tier class system, we see this class polarization is in their interest, or at least in their immediate interest. Those are the kinds of consensus values that emerge within their ranks of the elite, and then they're expressed through elite organizations, elite institutions, through the think tanks who formulate the position papers, articulating these points of view and advocating for public policies that advance these points of view, through media channels that disseminate ideas reflecting these points of view, who have these talking heads on who promote these ideas, through the print media even.
And then you, in the last point, and this ties in what we were talking about earlier about how the power elite uses demographic, cultural, and class conflict to protect its own position of dominance.
Yeah, well, I think that what we see is, on one hand, for a long time we've seen the establishment use a lot of social conflicts as a means of distracting public attention away from socioeconomic conflict. I think that's getting harder to do, and I think that's starting to change. But I do think that within the ranks of the political parties, for instance, you know, you see the Democratic Party for quite some time has positioned itself as the party of the traditional outgroups, the poor, the minorities, women, gay people, environmentalists, and so forth. And then the right, the Republicans position themselves as the party of the folks that they label as the salt of the earth, you know, the good, hard-working, church-going, middle America folks that are getting screwed by big government and by intellectuals and by the pathologies of the underclass and things like that. And that's the way political debates and have been framed in our own society for several decades now. But what's interesting is that the power elite tends to be over and above all of that, in the sense that if you look at for example, the funding of both political parties, you see that the genuine elite interests almost always have their hands in both parties.
Yeah, they cater to and exploit different demographic groups, but it doesn't mean they necessarily serve their interest, those groups' interest.
Exactly, and often it seems as though political contests are somewhat staged. You know, a good analogy is something like professional wrestling. You have in professional wrestling, you have this two combatants that are representing characters, and then they are fighting with each other supposedly, but the whole contest is scripted, and then you have the play-by-play announcer that's pretending like this is a real contest, even though the announcers know it's fake as well. And I think that's, to a large degree, how the American political system has operated for a long time. You know, your political contests are presented as, you know, Professor Liberal versus Mr. Conservative, and, you know, and then the media would present this as being a real contest, you know, a real political battle, you know, for control over the state or over the system. But but when it comes to power dynamics within the system itself, it really doesn't work that way. It's all still controlled by the top, by the true power elite, you know, those who do have this consensus about what their core values are as far as foreign policy and international relations, as far as statecraft, as far as public policy pertaining to economics, as far as banking and financial policy, industrial policy, you know, all of these things that are really substantive issues. You know, they may allow for there to be discussion and debate on some social issues, you know, whether there should be a death penalty or not, whether, you know, we should late-term abortion should be legal or not, whether there should be gay marriage or not. But when it comes to the bread and butter issues for the power elite, they're pretty united around their own interests.
And so you have this your most recent podcast is called Creating Alternative Infrastructure. And we are running out of time, but can you sort of briefly summarize that in a few minutes?
Yeah, well, that's a panel discussion between myself, Jeremy Weiland, Vince Reinhardt, and Todd Lewis. And we're a lot of what we're about at Attack the System is the idea of developing alternative infrastructure to the system, that is developing a type of parallel society, if you will, shadow institutions that largely operate outside the context of the system for the purpose of eventually building a large-scale alternative infrastructure. You know, one model we're always talking about is Hezbollah's organization in Lebanon, where you really have an organization that's a political party, it's a militia, it's a social service organization, it's a network of business enterprises, it's a religious movement, all rolled into one, and it largely exists independently of the Lebanese state.
Well, the thing is, the Lebanese state is very weak. The United States has a much stronger state.
Well, sure. But the principle is still the same, though, in the sense that what we're about is trying to encourage alternative infrastructures to grow in a way that do run parallel to establishment institutions, with the goal of eventually superseding established institutions in the long haul. And that can be something on a very basic level, like home schools or, you know, homeless feeding programs and things like that. It can also be alternative trade networks and do-it-yourself enterprises, worker cooperatives, alternative means of delivering social services and things like that, alternative money, Bitcoin, all of these kinds of things. There are a huge number of things like this already in place on some micro level, and it's all about trying to grow and expand these kinds of activities.
So yeah, with Hezbollah, they have a military sort of a paramilitary wing. So that part obviously would be, that part is different. But I think the key thing about Hezbollah that you bring up is the not the military aspect, but the aspect of providing social services. And the same is with the Golden Dawn in Greece. They also provide social services. So, and that's going to be an issue in the future when, as the economy gets worse and people are talking about what to do with healthcare and issues like social services. So I think that is a very important issue of having groups that provide alternative social services like healthcare and issues like that. Before I wrap up the show, is there anything else on that topic you would like to add?
Well, what you are saying is absolutely correct in the sense that as the economy continues to go down the tubes, there's going to be, on one hand, more and more demand for social services. But due to the fiscal problems of the United States and other countries as well, there's going to be less resources available for the state to maintain its social services. So as demand for social services increases, we'll probably see more and more cutbacks on social services. And that's where this idea of alternative infrastructure comes in.
So, Keith Preston, we covered a lot of issues, so I'd like to thank you for being on.
Thank you.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.